Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Wow, what a week this has been, with a mad abundance of snow at the start, and now, as I record, we are easing into warming, thawing, and the sound of drips coming off my roof. I'm recording outside today, so please pardon the shakes and shivers in my voice. What can I say? I just want to be outside. Our episode today was released by Ken Lane late on Valentine's Day last Friday, February 14th. Here is Surrounded in the Night.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, a winter storm cut loose from the mountains. The cold wind whipping around the creosote, rain dripping down through the swamp cooler vent. 20 and 25 came in like a lion, and it's the year of the snake. We've got both out here in the Mojave Wilderness. We've got mountain lions or cougars. And snakes, too. Although it's still a bit early to see our reptile friends up here at 4,000 feet elevation, they'll be out soon enough. They're already out where it's warmer. They're probably out by the thousands, down by the Gila River, the Salt River Valley. This rain coming down, rain here and snow up high in the mountains and the usual flooded highways and overflowing desert streams and rubbish all over the roads where the streams come across. Well, that just might be enough to make the flowers come up, make the little seeds that feed the various rodents that feed the snakes. All part of the system, the circle of life. The mourning doves have been lined up on the fence in the rain, taking their annual bath. Absolutely soaked to the skin, looking around at each other romantically. Thinking, now that we're nice and clean, dirty birds no more, how's about we pair off and have each happy couple raise up approximately 20 babies this spring and summer, one after another, until this fence can barely hold us all. Well, that's a good way to look at the season ahead, the year ahead. Consider your options, your opportunities, and propose your ideas, whether they be grand, romantic, or good enough. Well, sometimes people get bogged down because they picked up the weird prejudice somewhere along the way that everybody's got to be working away at some world-changing project or personal rehabilitation. Because I think they believe a lot of the gibberish nonsense they hear from other people, their peers, their frenemies, their colleagues, their comrades, their work buddies, their neighbors. Especially the people on the podcast, the half-outlawed TikTok, all repeating some variety of You've got to be protein maxing, retirement account maxing, having babies maxing, weightlifting maxing. Maxing is not even a word, although I guess it has become one. Never get precious about words, they always change. But the good ones stay, so keep using the good ones. We always come up with words, it's just better when the poets are doing it for the culture, you know, the wordsmiths. And not the guy pushing the dosing limits of testosterone supplements on YouTube, you know? Hank Williams gave his cold, cold heart, setting the woods on fire. And social media user LiftOrDie267881 gave his schizo posting and raw egg maxing. The late great Hank Williams also said there ain't a man living who hasn't talked to his dog. Old Hank said a lot of good things. Hank Jr. too. Hank Jr. might have made the best sounding country records of the 1970s. They sound as good on a trebly jukebox as they do blasting from the stereo and dashboard speakers of a pickup. The space around the instruments is wide open. The songs are catchy, they're hits. I used to frown on Hank Jr. when I was a kid because the purist only loved Hank Sr. But then my dad said, regarding Bocephus, these are good songs and he's a good singer. That's what matters. So I started borrowing Hank Jr. cassettes from my dad's El Camino, playing them in my own truck. And they really do sound as good as those 1970s Waylon records. Anyway, we're talking about protein maxing. I suppose. Stick to the script. If you are on the older side of life, you might not be seeing that kind of stuff online. The girl who eats steak and eggs and talks to the camera about her day, the couple building a cabin from $400 of mostly foraged building supplies, the many, many people lifting various weights. These are the younger people, mostly. They don't seem to have as much of the sadness and self-pity of the older generations, the older millennials and etc. Being optimistic about life goes a long, long way toward having a life worth being optimistic about.
Desert Oracle Radio.
July 3rd. As this was to be a point in our homeward journey, I made a cache, a term used in all this country for what is hidden in the ground, of a barrel of pork. It was impossible to conceal such a proceeding from the sharp eyes of our Cheyenne companions, and I therefore told them to go and see what it was they were burying. They would otherwise have not failed to return and destroy our cache, in expectation of some rich booty. But pork they dislike and never eat. We left our camp at 9, continuing up the South Fork, the prairie bottom affording us a fair road. But in the long grass, we roused myriad mosquitoes and flies from which our horses suffered severely. The day was smoky with a pleasant breeze from the south, and the plains on the opposite side were covered with buffalo. Having traveled 25 miles, we encamped at 6 in the evening, and the men were sent across the river for wood, as there is none here on the left bank. Our fires were partially made of the bois de vache, the dry excrement of the buffalo, which, like that of the camel in the Arabian deserts, furnishes the traveler with a very good substitute for wood, burning like turf. Wolves in great numbers surrounded us during the night, crossing and recrossing from the opposite herds to our camp, howling and trotting about in the river until morning. July 4. The morning was very smoky, the sun shining dimly and red as in a thick fog. The camp was roused with a salute at daybreak, and from our scanty store, a portion of what our Indian friends called the red fire water was served out to the men. While we were at breakfast, a buffalo calf broke through the camp, followed by a couple of wolves. In its fright, it had probably mistaken us for a band of buffalo. The wolves were obliged to make a circuit around the camp, so that the calf got a little start and strained every nerve to reach a large herd at the foot of the hills, about 2 miles distant. But first one, then another, and then another wolf joined in the chase, until the calf's pursuers amounted to 20 or 30. They ran him down before he could reach his friends. There were a few bulls near the place, and one of them attacked the wolves and tried to rescue the calf, but was driven off immediately, and the little animal fell an easy prey, half devoured before he was dead. We watched the chase with the interest always felt for the weak, and had there been a saddled horse at hand, the calf would have fared better. Leaving camp, our road soon approached the hills in which strata of marl, like that of Chimney Rock, made their appearance. It is probably of this rock that the hills on the right bank of the Platte, a little below the junction, are composed, which are worked by the winds and rains into sharp peaks and cones, giving them, in contrast to the surrounding level region, something of a picturesque appearance. We crossed numerous beds of small creeks, which in the time of rains and melting snow poured down from the ridge, bringing with them great quantities of sand and gravel. Over time, this has gradually raised their beds 4 to 10 feet above the level of the prairie, making each one of them a miniature Po. Raised in this way above the surrounding prairie without any bank, the long, yellow, winding line of their beds resembles a causeway from the hills to the river. Many spots on the prairie are yellow with sunflower. As we were riding slowly along this afternoon, clouds of dust in the ravines among the hills to the right suddenly attracted our attention. In a few minutes, column after column of buffalo came galloping down, making directly for the river. By the time the leading herds had reached the water, the prairie was darkened with the dense masses. Immediately before us, when the bands first came down into the valley, stretched an unbroken line, the head of which was lost among the river hills on the opposite side. And still they poured down from the ridge on our right. From hill to hill, the prairie bottom was certainly not less than 2 miles wide. And allowing the animals to be 10 feet apart, and only 10 in a line, There were already 11,000 in view. Some idea may thus be formed of their number when they had occupied the whole plain. In a short time, they surrounded us on every side, extending for several miles in the rear and forward, as far as the eye could reach, leaving around us as we advanced an open space of only 200 or 300 yards. This movement of the buffalo indicated to us the presence of Indians on the North Fork. I halted earlier than usual, about 40 miles from the junction, and all hands were soon busily engaged in preparing a feast to celebrate the day. The kindness of our friends at St. Louis had provided us with a large supply of excellent preserves and rich fruitcake. When these were added to a macaroni soup and variously prepared dishes of the choicest buffalo meat, crowned with a cup of coffee and enjoyed with a prairie appetite, we felt as we eat in barbaric luxury around our smoking supper on the grass, a greater sensation of enjoyment than the Roman epicure at his perfumed feast. Most of all, this seemed to please our Indian friends, who, in the unrestrained enjoyment of the moment, demanded to know if our medicine days came often. No restraint was exercised at the hospitable board, and to the great delight of his elders, one young Indian made himself extremely drunk. Our encampment was within a few miles of the place where the road crosses to the North Fork, and various reasons led me to divide my party at this point. The North Fork was the principal object of my survey, but I was desirous to ascend the South Branch with a view of obtaining some astronomical positions and determining the mouths of its tributaries, as far as St. Vrain's Fort, estimated to be some 200 miles further up the river and near to Long's Peak. There, I hoped to obtain some mules, which I found would be necessary to relieve my horses. July 5. Before breakfast, all was ready. We had one led horse in addition to those we rode and a pack mule, destined to carry our instruments, provisions, and baggage, the last two articles not being of very great weight. The instruments consisted of a sextant, artificial horizon, and etc., a barometer, spyglass, and compass. The chronometer I, of course, kept on my person. I had ordered the cook to put up for us some flour, coffee, and sugar, and our rifles were to furnish the rest. One blanket, in addition to his saddle and saddle blanket, furnished the materials for each man's bed, and everyone was provided with a change of linen. All were armed with rifles or double-barreled guns, and in addition to these, Maxwell and myself were furnished with excellent pistols. Thus accoutred, we took a parting breakfast with our friends and set forth. Our journey the first day afforded nothing of great interest. We shot a buffalo toward sunset, and having obtained some meat for our evening meal, encamped where a little timber afforded us the means of making a fire. Having disposed our meat on roasting sticks, we proceeded to unpack our bales in search of coffee and sugar, and flour for bread. Yet, with the exception of a little parched coffee, unground, we found nothing. Our cook had neglected to put it up, or it had been somehow forgotten. Tired and hungry, with tough bull meat without salt, for we had not been able to kill a cow, and a little bitter coffee, we sat down in silence to our miserable fare. A very disconsolate party, for yesterday's feast was yet fresh in our memories. And this was our first brush with misfortune. Each man took his blanket and laid himself down silently, for the worst part of these mishaps is that they make people ill-humored. Today we had traveled about 36 miles. From the journals of John C. Fremont, known as America's Western Pathfinder. As he headed west across the Great Plains in July of 1843. Your provisions include soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver on Desert Oracle Radio. John C. Fremont was born January 21, 1813, in Savannah, Georgia. He lived a long, adventure-filled 77 years and finally died on July 13 of 1890 in New York City. Fremont is one of the absolute principal figures in the creation of the United States West. And that includes California. I don't know if they teach California history in the California schools anymore. Maybe they give you a 2-page printout and ask you to photograph that text, use character recognition, send that to the AI chatbot, and then that'll send you something that you turn in for your homework, and now you know California's history. Or at least your search history knows California's history. His wife, the famed frontier writer Jessie Ann Benton Fremont, is, of course, better known for her writing than the writing of her husband's, but the thing is, in those days, with the educated people on the frontier, well, they could all write better than anyone who has lived in the last 75 years or so, and that is a fact. Maybe we can turn that around with the next generation after the Butlerian Jihad. And Jessie Ann Benton was born in May of 1824 in Virginia, and she died December 27, 1902 in Los Angeles, California. Now, many of John Fremont's adventures were also Jessie Benton Fremont's adventures, because she often came along and enjoyed the full thrills and hardships of frontier life. Jessie Benton Fremont was the daughter of Missouri Senator Thomas Hart Benton. Now, Benton was one of the main proponents of westward expansion of manifest destiny of America going all the way to the Pacific. He was John's sponsor and proponent, and in 1841, he became John Fremont's father-in-law. When Jessie Benton, who had already made a name for herself on the social circuits back east, became Mrs. John Fremont. And then her writing career really took off. Now, you can hardly throw a rock in the West and not hit something named for Fremont, including Fremont's Cottonwood. But there are places named for Thomas Hart Benton and or for Jesse Ann Benton Fremont, including Benton and Benton Hot Springs, California. And the truth is, she was editor and sort of the rewrite desk for John Fremont's reports. She is credited with giving them a literary quality. Her pieces for the Atlantic Monthly were collected in books including Far West Sketches and American Travel. From Amboy to Zyzix and broadcasting across the great western wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Visit our website at desertoracle.com. And thank you, as always, to our supporters who keep this commercial-free radio show on the air on the podcast circuit. They do that at patreon.com/Desert Oracle. We appreciate it. People ask me about things with varying degrees of hostility, impatience, and occasionally kindness, and as you can imagine, I generally only answer the latter category, which lately has included a number of queries about Desert Oracle events in the springtime that's nearly here. So nothing is planned at the moment. As usual, it is absurdly difficult to put together anything in the Joshua Tree High Desert due to the vortex. That's why you can't get anything done out here. Sorry. However, I am working on a new series of live events that some of you might enjoy and others will feign outrage over, and in that case I will also only pay heed to the former and not the latter. Might have some news in the coming couple of weeks. Was sure good to see the old pals last week at the Whistle Stop in San Diego, where we remembered our dearly departed Mojo Nixon, who left us 1 year ago. We watched that great documentary, The Mojo Manifesto. We whooped it up. And then on Super Bowl Sunday, with the interstates wide open, I shot back to the high desert in record time with a belly full of barbecue from El Cajon and Loretta Lynn's gospel album on the stereo. Got home in time to hike up the mountain with the dog, and we sat up there in the last minutes of golden sunset sunshine, the sky scrubbed clean by the last storm. Hey, you ever do the remote viewing stuff? I have put a common object on the seat of my office chair over there in the mail order department. Leave a comment on one of the social medias if you know what it is. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. So I'm going to read a couple of short sentences from Thoreau. On February 23rd, 1841, he wrote, "The care of the body is the highest exercise of prudence." And on February 24th, 1852, he wrote, "As we grow older, is it not ominous that we have more to write about evening, less about morning?" Well, obviously, John C. Fremont, who may have been in his late 20s or early 30s on his expedition, And this next author, Walter McClintock, he was 26 when he began the story that I'm going to read to you about. And so evidently they were not so old that they could only have something to write about in the evening. Anyway, I hope you like this. We heard Ken Lane read some writings from John C. Fremont on his show today. And I did a little research on John Fremont. He did about 5 expeditions, and the purpose of them was to explore and map the western United States. And he was about 29 when he did his first expedition, and he did 5 of them. And so age 29 going out and having these adventures, it's pretty impressive to me, and it really kind of puts things in perspective. Maybe how things have changed, maybe not. Also, his third expedition through the 5th expedition, in the information I found, were hampered by the Mexican-American War. So I'm assuming, I could be wrong, but it seems like this one that we heard about today may have been one of them when he was around 29, or maybe his early 30s. I don't know. I couldn't find the information as to which expedition this was. Anyway, so I'm going to read to you now some more writing from before our time, and it's from a book called The Old North Trail, Life, Legends, and Religion of the Blackfeet Indians, and it was written by Walter McClintock. Now, this writer, Walter McClintock, was actually a photographer, and he was about 26 when he began the story in this book. And I should mention that if you can find the Bison edition of this book, Bison Publishers, you will find a lot of photographs in the book that he took, which truly enhances what he has to say. But I wanted to read this to you because it's good to remember what the Glacier Park area was like before it got all developed. Okay, here we go. It was at the beginning of summer when we started on our journey across the Rocky Mountains toward the country of the Blackfeet. Our outfit was carried on the backs of pack horses. The trail was difficult and overgrown and frequently blocked by windfalls. Siksikakoan led the way with his axe, while I followed driving the pack horses. On the western slope of the Rockies, the forests are very dense because of the mild climate and abundant rainfall. The trees grow to a large size, and the undergrowth is luxuriant. We rode through glades where the rank masses of weeds and grasses were shoulder high, and past chains of beautiful lakes hidden in the gloomy recesses of the forest, where huge tamaracks, firs, and spruces grew to the water's edge and extended high up on the sides of the mountains. This was the haunt of deer, wapiti, and moose, many of their tracks being visible in the soft ground along the lake shores. A botanist would have been delighted with the great numbers of wildflowers in full bloom. I saw magnificent specimens of bear grass growing to the height of 5 feet. Their stalks were surmounted by dense caps of white flowers, each flower on an ascending pedicel an inch or more long. The leaves at the base of the stem were narrow and stiff. The root is used by the Blackfeet as a remedy for fractures and sprains. The leaves of a similar species are used by other Indian tribes in making baskets. There was also a great profusion of pink twin flowers with its vine of shiny dark green leaves, also bishop's caps, light yellow adder's tongues, and flowering dogwood. During our forest journey, I recognized many birds native to my home in the east. When passing lonely lakes, I heard the wild laughing cry of the loon and olive-backed thrushes singing along the shores. In the lofty pines were chickadees, winter wrens, hermit thrushes, and myrtle warblers. In the open glades were robins, doves, ruffed grouse, chipping sparrows, flickers, juncos, and tree swallows. Here I first became acquainted with the McGillivray warbler, his little head frequently peering out shyly from the willows along the streams. I found the nest with four eggs hidden away in some blackberry bushes close to a lake. In the bushes were vireos, flycatchers, and yellow warblers, and in the deep woods, woodpeckers, red-breasted nuthatches, and golden crown kinglets. We surprised a large bear sunning himself in the trail, but he quietly and quickly disappeared into the forest. The trail led through a broad valley and along the bank of a swift mountain stream, climbing continually upwards toward the Continental Divide. When we reached a high altitude, the trees became gnarled and stunted, and we were frequently enveloped in heavy clouds. Here were many tracks of bighorn, and we saw a band of Rocky Mountain goats high up on the mountainside. Hoary marmots, or whistlers, greeted us from the cliffs with their shrill calls, but they were so timid that they quickly disappeared on our approach. We entered a huge basin surrounded by towering peaks, a superb and vast amphitheater about 4 miles wide from side to side. At the bottom was a sparkling lake with wooded shores surmounted by a circular mountain wall with a sheer height of 3,000 feet. It was fed by many streams which had their sources in the glaciers and fell over precipitous cliffs with a constant roar, reverberating like thunder from the surrounding walls of rock. The Indians have given to the main range of the Rocky Mountains the appropriate name, Backbone of the World. Standing on the summit of the Cutbank Pass at 7,861 feet, we were surrounded by dazzling glaciers and stupendous mountains mantled with snow. The intense brightness of the snow fields was relieved by the dark green covering of forests which lined the valleys far below. 4 miles to the north lay the Triple Divide, the crown of the continent, where the watershed divides between the Pacific Ocean, Hudson Bay, and the Gulf of Mexico. Directly south was the sharply pointed Flinches Peak, which lifted its towering mass like a cathedral spire 5,000 feet above the valley. It is impossible from the illustration to realize the sheer precipitousness of this peak. And that's one of the photographs that he's referring to that he took that's in this book. On the west were Mount James, Mount Pinchot, and Ram Mountain, so called because frequented by many Rocky Mountain rams. To the northwest was Mount Blackfoot and the magnificent Blackfoot Glacier, a vast expanse of ice and snow. Beyond rose the summit of Mount Jackson, and under its shoulder, the Harrison Glacier, with its wonderful ice cascades. Turning farther to the north, we could see a multitude of peaks. Among them were Mount Silla, Little Chief, Going to the Sun, Four Bears, Almost a Dog, Mount Grinnell, and the Grinnell Glacier, Mount Red Eagle, and the Red Eagle Glacier, which is the source of Red Eagle Creek. The Grinnell Glacier is fenced on the west by a remarkable serrated ridge of the Continental Divide known as the Garden Wall. In close proximity are the Gunsight Pass, its contour resembling a gunsight, and the Sperry Glacier, the Sexton Glacier with its half mile of ice front, and the Swift Current Pass. Words fail to describe the magnificence of the glaciers and waterfalls, and the majesty and impressive beauty of the numerous high peaks and stupendous mountain ranges. Although this country is practically unknown, the difficult trails being frequented only by hunters, trappers, and Indians, its scenic wonders are probably unsurpassed by any within the United States. The region should be reserved by the government as a national park and game preserve. Okay, I'm going to end there, but I think it's very important to have a long-term view as much as we can of the place we live. We're going to go through changes. Change is the constant, right? Knowing the past and how it was in the past, I think, gives us a reference of things that we can look at that maybe we don't want to lose because of change, if we can help it. I guess if we are part of that change, we can monitor our own actions. That's just me. What do you think? This is from the back of the Bison Book edition of The Old North Trail by Walter McClintock. In 1896, when Walter McClintock went to northwestern Montana as a member of the U.S. Forest Service expedition, he made friends with the noted Indian scout Siksikcoen, and that means Blackfoot Man. And he was also known as William Jackson, and accepted his invitation to visit the Blackfoot Reservation. For the next 4 years, McClintock lived with the Blackfoot tribe, becoming a member of it after he was adopted as a son by Chief Mad Dog, their greatest orator, high priest of the Sun Dance, and keeper of the Beaver Medicine Bundle. During these years, McClintock kept accurate records of his experiences and investigations, and from them derived this richly detailed, authentic account of Blackfoot life and customs, first published in 1910. Along with descriptions of daily life, hunts, and ceremonials, there are vignettes of warriors and medicine men, reminiscences of the famous missionary Father De Smet, who was known to the Blackfeet as Long Teeth, legends and mythical stories recorded in the words of the narrators, and a hoard of information on such subjects as warrior societies, proper names, songs, and beliefs. The Bison Book edition includes the original illustrations, numbering nearly 200. And I'll add that Walter McClintock was, according to his birth date, he would have been 26 when he started on the journey that this book is about. Food for thought. What was I doing at 26? Now I have a couple readings for you from the book Nature, A Day at a Time, An Uncommon Look at Common Wildlife, by author, illustrator, and naturalist Kathy Katz. For February 23rd, the reading is about peregrine falcons. Falco peregrinus are the fastest birds in the world, racing through the sky at speeds approaching 200 miles an hour. Their spectacular aerial displays include diving toward Earth from heights of up to a mile, while somersaulting and barrel rolling in dramatic performances not seen in any other bird. And if these aerial stunts aren't enough to take their own breath away, they can also attack and snatch small birds from the sky that they pass to their mates, all in midair. And then there's a quote she ends it with. This is from Bruce Brooks in On the Wing. And he writes, "The speed is defiant. Sheer gravity cannot match it, nor can any device in the natural world. Certainly the otherwise fleet pigeon cannot, before it can faint or dash away, the peregrine hits it feet first with a colossal wallop, breaking its back and spraying its feathers in a puff like a down pillow burst in a kid's bedroom fight. And the reading for February 24th is all about bird's nest fungi, or Cyathus aula. They're related to puffballs and are pea-sized cups commonly found around gardens, compost piles, and old damp boards. These fungi are easily overlooked because of their size and color, blending in well with their surroundings. Miniature baskets hold several spore-filled eggs. They look like eggs, each of which is held inside by a cord. How are the spores released from their tethered position inside their cup? Raindrops, as powerful as a blast from a fire hose to a tiny fungus, splash inside the cup, forcing the eggs out. Each egg flies out with a cord dangling from behind, soaring through the air like a gaucho's bola. It wraps around the first plant in its path, entangling itself to its new host. Ultimately, the spores are distributed when an animal eats its host plant. Inside the animal's digestive tract, the case is dissolved, releasing spores that are ready to germinate when they travel out with the dung. And then the quote at the end of this entry is from Harold J. Brody in Fungi, Delight of Curiosity. And he writes, "One cannot escape a feeling of profound respect, and one is delighted by the beauty inherent not so much in the form or color of bird's nest fungi as in the means whereby they are able to compete successfully with other living things in the great contest for continuing survival." As things warm up, look for spectacular ice formations. Here's a field note from Montana Natural History Museum about one such formation, needle ice.
It's time for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center. It was midnight and dark, but when my boots made crunching noises as I walked along the dirt road, I knew what was underfoot. Tiny, clustered pillars of ice lifting the top layer of soil debris from the road. Now, in the light of the morning, the ice pillars look like miniature, partially buried, delicate ice castles. I am as intrigued by them now as I was when I first noticed them a few years ago, both here by Flathead Lake and up along McDonald Creek in Glacier National Park. I wouldn't have guessed that there was that much water in the soil, and I don't know why it freezes this way, in tiny columns rather than even tinier crystals distributed throughout the soil. It turns out that these small ice formations are called needle ice. Needle ice is a form of ice segregation. Soil moisture is usually fairly evenly distributed throughout the soil, but when ice segregation occurs, that soil moisture migrates to certain points in the soil and freezes in clumps, segregated from the rest of the soil. In the case of needle ice, the process of ice segregation requires a few specific conditions. There must be moisture in the soil. We didn't get the anticipated storm yesterday, but it did spit icy rain in the morning before the day warmed up. The texture of the soil must be loose enough that there is space between the soil particles, but compact enough that the pore space is small enough for capillary action to occur, which is frequently related to high quantities of clay and silt in the soil. I've only ever found needle ice in the bare soil of trails or infrequently used dirt roads. The ground must be unfrozen when the air temperature drops below freezing. The last few days have been in the 40s before a wind coming down Flathead Lake from the north dropped the temperature below freezing yesterday afternoon. I didn't notice any ice when I was out a little after sunset last night, but by midnight it had already formed enough to be loud beneath my hiking boots. Unseen by me, as night was falling and the air temperature continued to drop, moisture in the soil rose to the surface, drawn upwards against the downwards pull of gravity by the forces of cohesion and adhesion through narrow vertical channels in the soil in a process called capillary action. when the water arrived at the surface, or at the point slightly below the surface at which freezing was occurring, it froze along what is known as the ice interface. As more moisture was drawn upwards over the course of the night, it began to hit the bottom of the ice and froze in turn, in the shape of the narrow tube through which it was drawn up through the soil. The water coming up from below pushed the already formed ice upwards out of the soil, often in clusters of long, thin needles of ice that crunched underfoot last night and fascinate me again when I can see them this morning. Today's Field Note was written by Sarah Anderson. I'm Allison DeYoung for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center, providing natural history education for schools and the public throughout Montana. For information about upcoming events and programs at the center, call 327-0405 or visit our website at montananaturalist.org.
Well, my time's about up today. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you, Montana Natural History Museum, for Field Notes. And thanks to Kathy Katz. And thanks to KGBM and its supporters. And thank you for listening. If you want to reach me, the number is 406-404-6246. And you can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past shows are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. And if you have trouble finding that, contact me at that number I gave you, 406-404-6246. And let me know, and I'll get back to you and give you further directions if you need them. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams. And I'm going to close this out with a song I think I have had on the show before. And with all the news lately, I think it's appropriate. Here is Haunted by Sean James. Thank you, Sean. Stay strong to stand up for Mama Earth. She's worth fighting for, and so are the people that practice kindness. So help each other out, everyone. See you next week.
tests his might against what his eyes can't see, then he'll truly spot his foes and be